as soon as I got the role in X-Men Apocalypse, I got her email and we emailed kind of back and forth about where I was coming from approaching the character and if she had any like movies or music that she listened to or any kind of material that she read to kind of get into the psyche of Jean. And she also just kind of gave me her blessing for the role, which was really nice to have. Because, you know, when you take over a role from someone, you always kind of want to make sure it's okay with them. And she was lovely.
Hey, everybody. Neil Rosen here. That was Sophie Turner. Plays Jean Grey and Dark Phoenix, a dual role in the new X-Men movie Dark Phoenix. And welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm joined, as always, by Bill Bregoli.
I saw it.
And he did, and Bill McCuddy.
I didn't see it, and I'm glad, because Rotten Tomatoes says 15%.
And Bill Bregoli is going to tell us all about it.
Are we going to talk about anything else today?
Yes.
Sure.
We're going to talk about Framing John DeLorean. We're going to talk about a movie that also Bill Bregoli saw that he wants to discuss called The Cold Blue. It's a documentary that's on Netflix.
HBO.
Okay. And we're going to talk about another HBO miniseries, Chernobyl. Bill McCuddy's going to tell us about that. And
don't have a meltdown.
And a whole bunch of other stuff, too. In the meantime, why don't you tell us about Dark Phoenix, Bill Bregoli?
Well, yeah, sure. It's got all your basic young X-Men people in it. Not there's no Logan.
So it's the X-Boys?
It's the X-Kids, yeah. And in fact, Jennifer Lawrence, her character makes a comment to Xavier.
Professor X.
Yes.
And Jessica Chastain is in this briefly.
That's right.
Right.
She's in it too. And I'll explain what she is. But it focuses around Jean Grey's character. And you meet her as a very young little girl. It's an interesting scene. They're in the car. She doesn't like the music her mom's changing. So with her mind, she changes the station.
Wow.
And it takes place in 1975. And she changes it to Warren Zevon singing Werewolves of London, which actually didn't come out until 1978, but only a nerd like me would know that. But
that's why we have you.
That's right. And eventually her parents get into a car accident because she keeps changing the channels, and they die, or so she thinks they die. And she's taken care of by Professor X, or you know who I mean. Xavier,
played by
Patrick Stewart,
James McAvoy.
James McAvoy.
This is all the young version. He actually has hair at a certain point, and then eventually he shaves his head, and only for a little bit.
And do we see when she's young, Michael Fassbender as
yes, he shows up eventually.
As Magneto.
I'll give you a really concise view of the plot. She has anger issues, young Jean Grey, and she gets into a big fight with all of the X-Men, and she kills one of them accidentally. And if you want to know who gets killed, just go back into your tabloid, see who was tired of playing their character and doesn't want to do it anymore, and whose contract has run out. That X-person gets killed.
Ooh, a puzzle.
Yes. It's the way to figure these things out. Just check contracts.
Well, there's a lot of mystique surrounding this particular
Yeah, you can say that. And and so because she has the anger issues, actually she has the anger issues because she went in space with all the other X-Men and some weird cloud of energy got into her body. And she has way more power than she used to have. And these space aliens, of which Jessica Chastain is one, take human shape and walk.
I've never thought she was
of
this planet.
Yeah, she's very spooky in this. And they kind of try to get her to go over on their side and give them her power. And there are all these fights. They have to get Magneto into the action, played by Michael Fassbender. And there's a great big fight at the end that goes on too long, but it's less
Man,
than
I'm
2 hours.
Riveted by this,
I know.
Aren't you, Bill?
It's
well, the whole thing is like around 2 hours, and
less
they say
an hour and 15.
Literally,
minutes.
The Hollywood Reporter says this movie did not need to be made. Like it's unnecessary.
And it's not really, yeah.
Well,
unless
did they really need to? I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't know who they killed. I didn't see this, but the contracts are up. They say it's the last X-Men movie with this cast with Fassbender. With McAvoy, with Jennifer Lawrence.
One of those names you just mentioned is much more famous than the others.
Right,
so
right,
do
right.
The math.
That one goes
but
away.
But I'm saying, but I don't. You probably won't see Fassbender, regardless of what, I don't know which character does, but you probably won't see Fassbender back or McAvoy back. Anyway, they're all kind of done.
And they have something called The Young Mutants coming out in a few months,
oh, God.
Which will prequel this, I
that
think.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, they're done. It's fine. If you're into the X-Men, you have an okay time with it. People kind of, they laughed a few times and chuckled, and it's fine. I'm not going to even ask you guys if you're going to see it, because you won't.
How do you? Well, I love the first two X-Men movies, the ones that were directed by Bryan Singer. Was not that thrilled, although it wasn't bad, with the one that who took it over? Brett Ratner. Brett Ratner took over the third one.
Third one, yeah.
Bryan Singer directed some of it.
And this one is directed, for the first time director, by one of the producers who produced.
Yeah, and who and a writer as well. And in fact, Jennifer Lawrence insisted that he took it over when Bryan Singer was going crazy at one point.
Is Brett Ratner done for a while in terms of...
ask his lawyer. I don't know.
I wonder. Despite liking the X-Men movies, this doesn't sound like I should be running to this from your description.
Yeah, don't kill yourself. But if you really need air conditioning this weekend,
well,
and you want to kill a couple hours, you'd be fine.
It sounds like too much action. The thing I liked about the X-Men movies is they were very intelligent.
Pretty good emotional action between Jennifer Lawrence and Sophie Turner. And Sophie holds the big screen well. I know we've all seen her as Sansa in Game of Thrones, but she does fine. But I kind of wish she'd play something other than a historical epic or...
My wife doesn't get her. My wife says she doesn't think she's a great actress, and she doesn't think she's that hot. And I just nod in agreement.
Okay. That's what you're supposed to do.
That's what you're supposed to do.
You know, the two big things about this film that were supposed to be groundbreaking was this is the first X-Men movie which puts a woman front and center as the lead character.
Yeah.
And secondly, they go into outer space, which they've never done before.
And they were supposed to end in outer space too, but apparently they decided not to, so they have a great big fight on a train.
Okay. But is that that big of a deal that a woman is fronting the movie, considering it is a Marvel movie?
Yeah, and they haven't had that many.
You know, so you had Captain Marvel recently, and then on the DC side of things, you had the Gal Gadot stuff, you know what I mean?
Wonder for the Woman. X-Men, they've never done this, I guess, is the thinking.
So
it's too bad that it's a miserable failure.
It's okay. That's about it.
My wife really loves the X-Men movies, so I might actually go see it.
Bring her and see what she thinks. Yeah.
You know, but you're telling me, I mean, did you really love the first couple of them?
No.
Okay, so maybe you're the wrong audience.
I mean, who knows? I was fine with it.
All right, so we're going to talk about Framing John DeLorean, which is a documentary that opens this week. And it streams this week as well as opening this week in movie theaters, so you can do either. And Bill McCuddy, who's a car buff, why don't you talk us through this thing?
I will, and then Bill has a buddy in it that has a kind of a conspiracy theory about the film, which is kind of cool. Basically, John DeLorean was... a guy who was running almost the Pontiac division of General Motors. He was the wunderkind who came up with the GTO and the Firebird. And, he had longer hair.
Did he do the Camaro?
That was a Chevy.
Oh, that's Chevy.
That was Chevy.
Wasn't the Camaro, I'm sorry to interrupt, wasn't the Camaro kind of like the same body as like the GTO, but they just like...
No, it's the same as the Firebird.
Okay, because they did...
The same platform.
Kind of like
same
platform. Mercury and... The Mercury cars and the Ford cars, they're the same exact car with different grills.
Yeah, in those days they were doing something called badge engineering.
Badge?
It was referred to as badges.
Badges.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Which meant that they would have, all the cars would be the same, but they just threw different badges. This one's a Chevy. This one's a Chevy.
Right.
Okay, this one's a Pontiac. This one's a Chevy.
Yeah, and they would slightly change the front grille.
That was about it.
A little bit, and maybe the interior.
Yeah.
A little bit.
But
right.
So DeLorean says, let's put a V8 into this thing that was either the Tempest or the Le Mans, the same car. And they create the GTO. The marketing guys say, they'll never go for this. And, of course, it's a huge hit. So he's got a lot of juice at GM, but he's outspoken. And he one day writes a kind of a Jerry Maguire thesis paper that gets into the press. And all of a sudden, he's out of a job. So he knows a lot of people. He pinches the number one engineer, played by Josh Charles. I'm jumping ahead because this is a documentary.
Yeah,
but
a guy
it has,
named Bill Collins.
Has really actors in it.
Yeah.
They go invent the DeLorean that we know, if you're young and listening to this, from the movie Back to the Future. It was a gullwing, safe, cool car that was built in Northern Ireland because he got the best tax deals there. And one day, he's got no money, he's got to pay the staff, and he decides to go into the drug business. So they catch him, some FBI agents, trying to make a big coke deal in a suite, I think, in a Los Angeles hotel. Now, that's interesting, and there's lots of footage of, including the taped sting operation that the filmmakers get released, and there's plenty of material there to make a documentary. However, they added the extra layer of casting Alec Baldwin as John DeLorean, and then doing kind of a behind-the-scenes cinema verite movie within a movie being made. That seems unnecessary. So in other words, we see him putting the makeup on as John DeLorean. We hear him talking about the time that DeLorean lived and what he must have been thinking. And he was married to this gorgeous supermodel. And they recreate a lot of those scenes. Interestingly enough, they recreate scenes that they already had in the documentary footage. So it seemed redundant to me and it seemed padded. And into all of this, Bill Bregoli has a buddy who was in one of the scenes.
That's right.
In the recreation scene?
Yes. His name is Bill Hill, and he was in he was one of the guys, the General Motors suits, sitting in a conference room with John DeLorean saying, "You can't fit a big engine. It's never been done before. And the guys on the 14th floor won't buy this." Those being the big execs at GM. So that's my buddy Bill Hill, who's been in several other movies as well. And he says, I was telling him, "Hey, I saw you in this documentary." He says, "Documentary? That was..." The way they were telling us about it, it was going to be a feature film.
Interesting. Well,
which would make sense since we have some of the same scenes in the movie as documentary footage that are also recreated. Because I said on our show on CUNY recently, because we reviewed the film, it's kind of redundant in places.
Well, my problems, as I said on Talking Pictures show on CUNY as well, which, by the way, this weekend... it's streaming. You can go to tv.cuny.edu. It's on YouTube, and it's also, I'm going to be on All Arts this Friday several times during the day, which is we're
channel 4012.
No, right? Just go to. Well, I'll send links out on the All Arts so you can look up your cable provider and figure it out. But it's streaming also. Anyway, here's my problem with this movie. As you said, Bill McCuddy, you know, to put it succinctly, it really can't decide what it wants to be. I mean, there's the documentary part. There's the drama part where they recreate the scenes. And Alec Baldwin, by the way, being Alec Baldwin, takes me out of the movie because I'm seeing the real DeLorean. It's not like we're even watching like a feature film where, okay, Alec Baldwin is playing DeLorean the whole time, and then after a while I adjust to that. But I'm looking at footage of the real DeLorean. Then I'm looking at Alec Baldwin, who looks like Alec Baldwin. So it's taken me out of the movie. And then there, as you said, Bill McCuddy, the cinema verite aspect, where like there are these scenes about him getting the prosthetics put on and the hair and the makeup, and he's going...
It all seems like padding in a movie that's about 2 hours and really doesn't need any padding.
And Baldwin's going, "Gee, let me see. Does this look right? Do I have the voice down? You think we'll play this?" So you know, it's like a making of movie. Then it's the movie, the drama, feature film part of it. And then there's the documentary part of it. So it's all over the map.
We should mention also that the real-life children... So his ex-wife, Christine Ferrara, didn't want to participate in this. But his kids do, and the kids are pissed off, especially the son.
Yeah.
So they're interesting. Like, they're interesting in a documentary. And again, this is just one more reason, I think, you don't need Alec Baldwin and Josh Charles and all of the other people who are doing these extra scenes.
But if you had a movie, like Bill Bregoli said, where you had the whole movie with Josh Charles now, and you had a...
Well, that's what he's saying. Maybe that was the intention, and they scuttled it in the middle.
But, you know, this it's kind of like... I don't know. I found the documentary, to be honest, out of all of it, I found the documentary part to be the most interesting. And
yeah, I'm still recommending it because he's a charismatic guy, and there's tons of footage that's never been seen before, and it's pretty cool.
And the beginning was interesting, as you say, when he decides to leave General Motors or is told to leave General Motors and starts his own thing. And then, you know, we know the story, but if you don't, you know, he goes broke with the car and starts drug money and all this kind of stuff, and that's... But, you know, I don't know. It's there's a word in Yiddish. You always use Yiddish words, Bill, and get their definitions wrong. But
I'll tell
you a Yiddish word called ungapachka, which means...
Ooh.
That it's it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this, and all three of these, all these things don't mix up together. They don't, the soup doesn't blend.
Sort of like the podcast.
All these different ingredients that you wouldn't think work actually don't work.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, and that's the deal on that. So, I don't recommend it. Bill McCuddy does recommend it. Do you recommend? What's your opinion on it?
I wish it told me more things like, why did they choose this stainless steel body? And tell me about that Renault engine that never really worked very well. The car
wasn't supposed to have a six-cylinder Renault Volvo engine. It was supposed to have like an eight. It was supposed to be. That was the problem. It came out and it wasn't fast. It was very cool looking.
It handled
okay. It kind of was mid-engine, but it wasn't exactly. It was mostly over the rear wheels. And so it was kind of a misfire, and it was nobody's idea of a perfect car.
Yeah, but...
point out that they're still all on the road. And one of the cool things is you never think DeLorean's going to show up at... he was so in denial about the whole thing, and he shows up at one of the swap meets that they throw. And I wanted more stuff like that.
Yeah, but this also was kind of interesting towards the end. They show you his designs for the next version of the next, which never saw the light of day, of the next DeLorean that came out. You don't remember that?
No. But I'll take your word for it.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway. All right. So that's that.
I recommend it.
So moving on, there's an HBO documentary, Bill Bregoli.
That's right, called The Cold Blue. C-O-L-D, Blue. And it's an interesting idea that's kind of been done before, but for a different war. This is a guy named director Eric Nelson managed to get a hold of footage of the 8th Air Force that was shot for Memphis Belle by William Wyler.
And I heard about
not
this.
Not used. It wasn't used in the final product, but it's been sitting around for years. He digitally restored it. And
Memphis
interestingly
Belle,
enough,
for those who don't know, was one of the two planes.
Or for those who weren't going to listen to Bill for another 5 seconds, he was getting to it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
No, it was about an airplane that fulfilled its number, I think, 25 missions, and they could go home.
It's a B-52, right?
No, it was a B-17.
Oh, okay.
And, so that was a big hit, and I think Roosevelt wanted the whole country to see Memphis Belle, and they took the guys, but it's not about that at all. It's really just that footage. And what this director did was go and interview living veterans of the 8th Air Force. None of the Memphis Belle guys are alive anymore, but he found guys who were in the same Army Corps and they're still alive. And they sort of narrate and talk about the footage, about the food that they ate, being in Britain, going for missions, being told that they have to fly even more missions. And these guys are really fun. You don't get to see them until the very end of the movie because the director didn't want to kind of take you out of it. He wanted you to see what it was like to actually be in the 8th Air Force in those days and not know if you're going to live or die the next day. There's some very interesting observations by the guys, and they're a cranky, funny bunch. Some of them are obviously had PTSD as a result of this, and some of them didn't.
But the footage is from the plane itself, like up in the front.
Different
like
plane,
like flying
plane,
over
flying
and watching
over,
bombs
you
drop.
See,
and
you're seeing flak go off. In fact, you can actually see the director realized once he had everything digitally restored. By the way, it was shot in color to begin with. So this is not colorized footage like Peter Jackson did in his documentary.
Right.
This is real color footage.
What's that Jackson one called? They're Not Coming Home, or They're Dead, or...
Always Remember Us.
Yeah.
That's available
They Will
now.
Not Be Forgotten.
They will not be forgotten. How ironic I couldn't remember that. That's streaming currently also.
Right.
I just
want
to give that a plug.
Where is it streaming? On what platform?
Many platforms.
Okay. Well, this you'll...
like Netflix or Hulu? Or?
It's on Spectrum, your favorite.
But so it's on... you got to pay for it. It's not like...
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well,
Amazon.
And anyway, HBO, you can see this thing Thursday night, which is the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, wow.
So it's very apropos. These guys, some of them went off to Normandy, and this part of England was where all those guys took off. So I do recommend you see it, especially if you're like me, a middle-aged old guy, World War II buff. It's fun to watch.
So I did the Handmaid's Tale junket yesterday, which the first three episodes just debuted of season 3.
Did you tell them how much you think it sucks?
On Hulu, I did, and that's what I'm going to tell you about
now. Oh, okay.
Ooh. So,
you buried the lead.
Yeah.
So this is your last junket?
So I'm so I'm 6 episodes in, and I guess the general public that's into the show is 3 episodes in since they just released the first 3 on Hulu. And I interviewed the showrunner, executive producer and showrunner, as well as Aunt Lydia, if you watch the show, and the one who plays the Martha, and the one who they took one of her eyes out.
Didn't they give you Elizabeth Moss?
Elizabeth Moss. Not only did they not give me Elizabeth Moss,
but the people, because they heard the people you don't like it.
No, I'm going to get to that in a second. The people that did get Elizabeth Moss, she was late. They cut down all of the Elizabeth Moss interviews, which were very few. Everybody got 2 minutes. So I did not get her. And Yvonne Strahovski and Joseph. Oh, and I also got Max Minghella, who plays.
So when you ask for the wind it up at 2 minutes, they give it to you right when you start.
Well, I don't know. I didn't get Elizabeth Moss. But here's what I said to the showrunner. I didn't say it sucked, but here's what I said. I said that at the end of season two of The Handmaid's Tale, the Elizabeth Moss character, June, is given an opportunity to escape. I also interviewed Bradley Whitford. Is given an opportunity to escape. And the entire two seasons, all she's trying to do is escape from this horrendous world that she's been in. You know, she's in a car and she can't, the garage door is locked and she's trying to smash through the garage door with the car by gunning the car. She's in a plane and you think she's going to get out of there, and the last 2 seconds before the plane takes off, people with guns ground the plane. So all she's doing for the two seasons is trying to get out of this horrible world where they're just raping her like every day, and it's the worst thing imaginable. So finally, at the end of season two, which I've talked about on this show, Bradley Whitford drives her to some place and gives her the opportunity to escape. And the last minute of the show, she's like,
I guess we
like,
could call this a spoiler.
No, this is the end of season two.
Yeah, I mean for anybody who hasn't seen him at all.
Goes,
like me.
No, I'm staying. My daughter is here. And I said to all these people, all the people that I mentioned in this junket, don't you think that's an unrealistic choice? And don't you think that that's a contrivance by the writers? Because if she leaves, you got no more.
Haven't you told us in the past that the book or whatever this is based on sort of ended?
The book
at season
ended.
Two,
I brought that up too. The book ended at season one.
Oh,
season
okay.
two was all off the rails. Although Margaret Atwood, who wrote the book, is a consultant on the series, and they told me that her fingerprints are all over the unwritten book seasons.
Right.
But all of them said the following. They said, "No, it's not an unrealistic choice. That if you have a daughter." And I have
You have a daughter.
Anne Dowdy,
I have
said,
a daughter.
I have three kids. I would now. I go, yeah, but she's powerless. She has no kids. She's in this raping situation. Well, how would you make a choice like that? So the one who gave me the best answer, they all kind of said that. But the one who gave me the best answer was the showrunner, the executive producer of the show.
That's why he's running.
Who said to me, we wrestled with the same exact problem in the writer's room that you are talking about right now. And half of the writers were like, we can't do this. It just doesn't make any sense. And it would make more sense if she did escape to Canada and then she led a whole, you know, started a whole movement and rebellion to try and, you know, bring down the Gilead government and get her daughter back that way. And we discussed that. But we decided to go with the fact that it was an impulse thing, that it wasn't premeditated. When faced with actually getting on that truck and being driven to Canada, the last second, she's like, no, I got it. I can't do it. I got to leave my daughter.
So your question cut to the core, mister.
So I asked the question. I didn't say it sucks, but I said I found that to be an unrealistic motivation on the character's part.
Leading to a season now that you don't like. But you didn't get to that part, obviously.
The
showrunner had to ask you if you like it now, and you had to say,
No.
The showrunner didn't care whether Neil likes it or not.
No, that didn't come up, but I wanted that addressed because I felt that it was, you know, it would be like, you know, in The Great Escape, you know, like with Steve McQueen, like the whole movie, they're trying to get out of there.
Right.
And finally they're like, hey, look, here's a secret door, we can get out of here. And they're like, No.
Or
no.
a boat pulls up on Gilligan's Island, and Gilligan's like, I'm good.
I'm all right. You know,
Thanks.
We're fine here. Professor's making that radio out of coconuts, and we're good. Yes, so I did address it with everybody. They all vehemently defended the decision, but the showrunner did give me the best answer.
Now, do you have a package for anybody without Elizabeth Moss?
Yeah.
Like, where are you going to use this, besides telling us about it, where are you going to use those?
Oh, I'll put something together.
Okay.
On,
well, you know how we worry. So I saw all six, or actually five, of what I think is maybe one of the best things HBO has ever bought. I think they bought it from Sky. It's Chernobyl, and it's I highly recommend this. I thought I knew everything about it, but like the Russian people to whom it happened, I really didn't know all that much. And the horrific way that this whole thing was handled. First of all, in the very first episode, the meltdown happens. This is in the 80s. I'll remind anybody who doesn't know, Chernobyl is a part of Russia that had a nuclear power plant, and it had an accident. And the Russians tried to cover the whole thing up, like Watergate. And it started to leak out, literally, the radiation, but also the stories about what was happening there. And Jared Harris, who was so great in Mad Men and hung himself in that, cannot stop hanging himself because he hangs himself in the first 2 minutes of this thing, and then it flashes back. He's put in charge because he's a nuclear physicist of explaining to the government, including Gorbachev and all the party leaders, what's going on. And then he's in charge of, or co-in charge with Stellan Skarsgård, who's the hard-ass, you know, Russian party member, of cleaning all this up. And literally people are dying just standing in the water, cleaning it up. So it's very challenging. It's also about how they lied to everybody.
Five parts.
One, the first one is about an hour and 12 minutes. The last one's an hour and a half. The others are about an hour. And it's so well done and so well written that it's a story you think you know and you absolutely should see. So I recommend it.
Did you watch the whole thing?
Yes, I've said that three times.
So did they show you like,
there's some gruesome footage if that's where you're going.
No,
yeah,
this
these guys, the skin literally starts melting off these people.
Oh, God. Well, I was going to say on the outlying perimeter of Chernobyl, did some of this radiation just sort of like in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, where like it took a couple of years, but people started feeling effects.
Oh, no, absolutely. They won't admit how many people got cancer,
you know, like,
but
the
for
people,
one
like,
thing.
That instantly died in Hiroshima or Nagasaki, that they're dead instantly. But then those people that had.
No,
like,
no, that's the whole problem.
Those effects
were
like.
It's like thyroid cancer. There's some cancer that kids never get that like 20,000 kids got.
Ugh.
So it's devastating.
And when they say they were told nothing, my fencing coach is from the Ukraine. He lived pretty far away from Kiev, but he's from that area. And he said when it happened, he was living there, and they were told nothing. And he's actually, to this day, a little pissed off at the Russian government.
Well,
about
you know,
this.
It's not just the Russian government. I have to tell you the truth that, you know, the people that died in the World Trade Center on 9/11 were told, a lot of them, that everything is fine, return to your offices, and we've got the situation under control. So why would you, considering I remember being a kid and they had fire drills where, like, you know, just in case there's a fire, they just evacuate you and you just have to quickly run to the exit. We've all had fire drills.
You're a kid. We had duck and cover in my day.
Yeah, we had duck and cover.
Did you have duck and cover in Chicago or wherever the hell you are there, Bill? Yeah.
Evanston, Illinois.
No, the duck and cover was before my time. But, I'm saying they didn't, from what I've read about this, is they were telling people to return to their desk. And why would you do that?
Actually, we lined up out in the hall, and I always thought that makes like a human wick for the fire. It's just going to go from kid to kid.
Well, if you remember the day, Bill McCuddy, when the show was canceled on New York One, Talking Pictures, which is now...
I'm wearing a New York One hat today in that honor.
Brilliantly, thank God, is on CUNY TV and All Arts. There was a fire in the building that
That's
day.
That's right.
And we
That's
all
right.
had to evacuate the building. And I was told,
why didn't we see that as a sign?
Well, that's what I said when I got called in after they got the fire done. I said, you sure you want to cancel the show? Do you believe in omens? You know,
just add a D to the word fire.
Just add a D. And that's very funny. Very, very funny. There you go. So
what's happening next week?
Well,
there's one other thing.
Do we want to wrap up?
Why not? We run out of things to say. Let's not
really
take up people's precious time.
I saw.
Oh, okay.
That's 3 years old. Let's save that for
you
next year.
You want to save that? It's fascinating.
Next week is
Wait a minute. Don't tease it like that. It's about Google, right?
No, it's a documentary about actually this woman who fought Robert Moses. and how all these urban housing, urban development housing projects, and about Moses and how he would have wanted to put a highway in the middle of Manhattan that would have destroyed Soho and the West Village, and he wanted to put a highway which would have destroyed Fire Island, like and all these things. And this woman, she was amazing, and she, like, this guy had so much power. And it's called Citizen Jane, Battle for the City, but we could talk about it at another time if you'd like.
Well, I think we've talked about it enough. Do you recommend it?
I do.
I want to see it.
It's okay. Fascinating. Okay. All these things that...
Where is that? What platform? You always ask. Which platform?
The platform is on Hulu. You need Hulu.
Hulu. I'm sorry. When you said earlier there was a Hulu documentary you wanted to talk about, I thought you said Google documentary.
No, I said Hulu.
Me too.
I did. I thought, oh, I'm going to hear about a Google documentary. Robert Moses, I don't care so much. No, He did design a lot of the things in the city, right? The West Side Highway and the...
There's a book that won the Pulitzer Prize called The Power Broker, which is a fascinating book, which is... I've never gotten through the book because it's like 8,000 pages, but I've read parts of the book. But they say that the first part of his career, he did amazing things. He built the Triborough Bridge, and he built Jones Beach. By the way, a really fucked up thing about Jones Beach is he built the bridges to be too low, so buses couldn't go to Jones Beach, because he didn't want, you know, back in the 1930 when they built Jones Beach, if you had a car, you were a person of means. And he didn't want poor people attending his beach. So the...
Does he use the word coloreds? Does he use the word...
No,
does he ever say...
He
it's says, nothing racist, it's
he
just
says poor, well,
class.
It is very racist, but he used the words people of means and poor people. So if you drive down... Southern State or whatever it is in New York City, you'll see that those bridges are very low. They can't fit. And if you go into Jones Beach also, there are these tunnels that you have to walk through to get to the beach. And it was all designed
to keep this tall to ride
buses
this ride
out. Then they built the LIE and they built the Northern States. So, you know, there were ways, and then the Meadowbrook, so there were ways around the thing. But at the time...
Well, I'd like to think the HOV lane is for...
Just for classy folks.
Yeah, high wealth people. I don't want to see... A Pinto.
The HOV lane?
Yeah, on the LIE.
People have to bring somebody along on the
car. You need your Tesla or something.
Anyway, this Robert Moses guy was a piece of work.
And again, say the name of that film again.
The name of the film is Battle for the City, and it's Citizen Jane. Battle for the City.
I've heard
of that. Woman who, if it wasn't for this woman, it seems like we wouldn't have the wrought iron district and Soho and many of the things that we love about New York today that are remnants from another era and are just beautiful.
Is she still alive?
They don't tell you that. It's a 3-year-old documentary, and they don't tell. They actually don't tell you that in the documentary.
But she was alive at the time.
She was alive
in the 20s
time that they
or
made
whatever.
A documentary to do an interview.
So she was alive in the documentary.
In the documentary,
she's
alive now.
She's quite old, I imagine.
I don't know. So what's coming up next week, Bill Bregoli?
Shaft.
When are you seeing Shaft?
Well, I've seen it already, baby.
And?
It was the last screening in the Warner Brothers screening room.
Oh, my God. These screening rooms keep dropping like flies.
It may come back. I'll tell you about it after the podcast, because I'm not going to take up anybody's precious time in this industry gossip. But Men in Black International or whatever they're calling it.
Well, I have no interest in that. And I like some of the people in it, but I don't know. You got Men in Black with a woman. Just seems weird. And I know I'm going to get lots of hate mail from Lisa Rossman on that.
Late Night next week.
With Emma Thompson. No, that's opening this week. Emma Thompson.
It's opening Limited this
Limited this week.
And it's opening
Mindy Kaling.
Why next week? We could talk about that if you'd... Have you seen it?
No.
I've seen it.
No. We'll talk about it next week.
We'll talk about it next week. I have to go to work. Let's go.
He's got a real job.
All right. So we've got Late Night, and we've got Men in Black International, and we have Shaft.
The family comedy. It's good times.
That's right. It's a comedy.
Comes to
I'm
Shaft.
Doing the junket this weekend.
I may as well. If I can fit it, take a ride up to Harlem with you, because that's where they're doing it.
Yep, that's correct. They provide us with transportation.
Oh, they do.
Will you get Samuel Jackson?
Yes.
I made Shaft before, and I'd do it again.
And it's Richard Roundtree.
What's in your wallet?
What's in your wallet?
Three generations of Shaft.
Billions of dollars. Okay. Yeah, it's I hear it's bad, and I'm really sad about that, because the original Shaft with Richard Roundtree was one of my favorite movies.
But then they had a second
1972.
Shaft. 10 years ago, they had the Samuel Jackson Shaft. Do you remember?
Right, that Richard Price wrote, and he told me it was a paycheck. But they had three Shafts actually.
This is the third Shaft.
No, there were three Shafts in the beginning.
Oh, you mean the sequel, the Shaft?
Yeah, yeah.
Shaft.
Shaft's Big Score and Shaft in Africa.
Right. Did you like Superfly better or did you like Shaft?
I liked both about the same. Obviously, Superfly was made for a lot less money, but they both have incredible soundtracks.
What's the better song? Yeah, what's the better song?
I think Shaft is a better song, but Superfly is a better soundtrack.
Pusher Man, is that Superfly or Shaft?
No, that's Superfly.
Yeah, that's a great soundtrack.
Curtis Mayfield did that whole soundtrack, as Isaac Hayes did the whole Shaft soundtrack, but the soundtrack for Superfly is just unbelievable.
I agree. But
Freddie's dead. Yeah, dead is Fred.
That's what I said. Yeah. But I will tell you, both are iconic.
Where there's hope was a rope, and he should have known.
That guitar riff at the beginning of Shaft.
Yeah.
Down. Is that a bass or a guitar? I think it's bass.
It's a wah-wah pedal.
Is it a wah-wah pedal?
Okay.
Well, anyway, it's indelible. And the Superfly thing is great. So there you go. So a lot to talk about next week.
And Bill just lost his job, so now we can stay and talk longer.
What? Right.
No.
Oh, Bill lost his job. Okay. Anyway, you can reach Bill McCuddy at Bill McCuddy.
Yeah. On Twitter. Thank you.
Reach me at Neil Rosen Apples. And Bill Bregoli, as we talked about last week, shockingly, and I think he put one picture on there.
Oh, I've got a whole bunch. I put some on last night.
Oh, my God.
He can see inside my apartment.
Has an Instagram account. So he's more cutting edge now than McCuddy and me.
I have an Instagram account with like 100 followers, and I've never posted it.
I don't know. My daughter tells me, like, that's where it's at.
Instagram is for pictures, and Twitter is for words. And I write. I don't take pictures.
I'm with you, buddy.
And speaking of pictures, we watch the bad ones so you don't have to.
And we want to thank you for sitting around talking movies with us this week. And we'll sit around talking movies with you again next week.
You can't stop us.